Of Film Festival at the Open Doors section. I'm very pleased to talk with Nitu Patience Mwesiga.
Yes.
Please correct me.
Nitu Mwesiga, yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
You are from Uganda.
Yes.
And could you tell us about the formation you did to get to realize films?
To get to be a filmmaker?
Yes.
I've grown up on stories. I grew up in a big family, an extended family of uncles and aunties, and every evening while people are making dinner, we sit around the fire and tell stories. Yes, in Uganda. It's actually not in the city in Kampala. I grew up in a very similar place to like Locarno. It's mountainous. It's called Buhweju. And it's cold in the evening, so there's always a fire. And my aunties would tell me lots of stories. And I didn't know I'd be a filmmaker. I thought I would be a novelist. And then I fell in love with cinema in school. And that's how I ended up a filmmaker. Yeah.
It's another way to tell stories, Nitu. Either
yes.
with a camera, either with a pen.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. It's just that, you know, when you're growing up, I grew up also around a lot of books. My parents were teachers. So I read a lot of books and I loved how books are like, it's like stories are like traveling, you know, you go to a new place, you learn about it, even though you've never been there. So for me, you know, when I fell in love with stories, it was just like, I first started writing, and that's why I'm a writer-director, because writing is my first love. And when I discovered cinema as well, I was like, this is another layer to storytelling. You can add pictures, you can add movement, yeah.
Storytelling is very important in the African continent. So I guess it was a part of your RNC.
Yeah. It's part of our education also. Like storytelling is, for us, it's not just entertainment. It's also education. It's how you pass on wisdom from the older generation to the new generation. And I have folk tales that I received from my mother that I tell to my child now. And so for me, when I tell a story, I always think about what it's like a time capsule, you know, what am I sending into the future? What am I putting in here that people who come after me will see and say, oh, it used to be like this, you know, yeah.
It's very important because nowadays we believe no more people would read a book, only on internet, online things. So books are still very important. There's a dictum in Africa, we say when an old person dies, there's a library dying.
Yes, absolutely. And it's so true, you know, like our old people. And because also in Africa, our history is orally transmitted from one person to another. Mm-hmm. So when an older person dies, it's like all that information, all that wisdom, you know, it goes with them. So when there's a story that's told, it's sort of like a preservation also of that wisdom. It's of course, it's also entertaining. Even if you look at like our folk tales, they're very epic. They're very entertaining, but they also carry like all these messages and wisdoms, from the past and the present. Yeah.
Nitu, you just said that the part of writing is very important. Writing script, you wanted to be a novelist. And what about the way you invest the writing time?
Writing for me is very spiritual, actually. Because before I write, I live with characters in my head. I dream about my stories. I don't see writing for me as just like only a craft. For me, it's also like being a vessel for ancestors to pass on stories. So sometimes I sit for months with stories in my head. I walk around with them. And then at some point I feel ready. So I start writing. It starts with characters for me. And then I start building worlds around them. And then it takes really a lot of months for me to come to a script. And when I'm ready for a story, I start with the narrative stuff. I do my synopsis. I do my treatment. I do story outlines. The script is the last thing for me. It's very last stage.
Is it a kind of spiritual transformation?
It is. It's very spiritual and transformative, and it's very also like a communion with my past and my future self, and also with my ancestors in a way, because the way I look at story is that, you know, it's an experience. It's also like traveling again. It's going to a place and visiting people and talking to them. I spend a lot of time with them, and of course they transform me, and I listen a lot. I talk to myself. I go in the bathroom and take like 2 hours in there and talking to all these characters, and of course they don't leave me the same at all. Yeah.
Need to the link between past and future then.
I believe so, and also between like what we can see and what we can't see, because on the African continent we believe in like multiple realities. So I think sometimes there's things that we're not able to understand in like a material world, but when you're writing, like some of that information is passed on to you, and sometimes it's hard to understand it, but it comes through on screen. Yeah.
So after writing, you started to think about making films. How was this way to cinema?
In terms of collaboration?
In terms of personal transformation first, and then collaboration, of course.
Yeah. So, okay, I write, and then even when I'm still writing, I think about the images on screen. I also studied theater, so I'm used to like a lot of performance, and also the way African stories are told. There's a lot of performance, there's a lot of music, it's an amalgamation of a lot of like...
Dance?
Yes, there's a lot of dance, there's, you know, so all those things inform me. Mm-hmm. And even though there's like no actual dance in or singing, there's a lot of like lullabies, so a lot of my films include a lot of also like... rhythm and music, and even if it's not sung per se by the characters, it's like music that relates to the theme that's, you know, included in the soundtrack, because cinema allows you to do that. So I think a lot about my images, and I write a lot with music. I'm inspired a lot by music. I listen to a lot of bands. I discover a lot of stuff when I'm writing. I watch photos. I'm inspired by all these visual and also sound surroundings that end up in the film. And even if they don't, like the mood can be of each scene is influenced by a lot of all these other things that I've been listening to and watching.
Lots of influences.
Yes, absolutely.
And from the point of view of sound, visual as well.
Yeah.
How did you work on cinematography?
I really love collaborating with the cinematographers. And each film for me is like a new experiment. And so I like talking and planning a lot with my cinematographers. I give them the script, they read it, and then we sit down and talk about every single shot, every single... Of course, a few things change, but I really love collaborating a lot with cinematographers. I also love being inspired by them, because I think one thing I love about film is it's not just the thing that's in my head. It also gets to be inspired by the people who work on it. So when I work with a cinematographer, I want them to read the script, and then I want them to tell me how they see it. And so we sort of collaborate in that way. Like, I tell them what I see, they tell me what they see. And sometimes if they have a way that's different from mine, that makes sense. I like, you know, being challenged and seeing it from their point of view and, you know, collaborating together like that. Yeah.
The film you presented in Open Doors section here in Locarno,
yeah.
It's Django.
Yes.
Could you tell us about the inspiration for this film, about the story?
So Django is a Luganda word that means come. It's like a beckoning to call someone to you. And it's about two sisters who are going home on a Friday night. It's late and they get robbed by their cab driver. So they go to a witch to ask for a safe passage home. It was inspired by a lot of fear that I experienced at a certain point a few years ago. I was attacked while going home at night. I used to love going to cinema late at night because there's no people in the street, so then we'd walk home. So this one time I was actually coming from a shoot, a friend's film set, and I got attacked in the street and I survived. I was saved by a security guard. And it made me so scared I can't walk at night anymore. So I wanted to make a film that explores that fear of, you love one thing, I love nights, I love walking at night in the street, and I can't do it anymore because of that. So it's, you know, it's about these girls who, and that's why I use a lot of like very wide shots, because I wanted the city and the streets to be bigger than these girls.
The city is a protagonist.
Yes, absolutely. And the society in that sense, you know, of, we don't even see the driver who attacks them, because it doesn't matter what face he wears. For me, it's just like being denied a chance to feel safe, to feel comfortable in your own streets, but also the consequence of, okay, if I want to be safe, does that mean that I'm bad? Does that mean that I hate men because I'm disappointed that they don't make my city safe for me?
That it means that I don't go anymore to theaters.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a challenging film for me, but it's also like a conversation about that, you know, the fact that you live with yourself. You can't live in fear all the time, but you also live with it.
It's like the traumatism.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's questioning as well the situation of women.
Yeah,
in general.
Yeah, being a woman and wanting to be yourself without taking anything from anyone else. Because I think as a woman and as a feminist, every time you want to occupy space, everybody's like, oh, but you're taking it away from other people. And it's like, no, I don't want to take space away from other people. I want them to exist, but I want it to be safe enough for me to exist in that space as a woman, without violence, without a threat to, without wanting to dress up so that somebody else doesn't get offended, you know, in all those ways, yeah.
So, as a feminist, you must be very interested to talk with Yasir Faiz, because he's always talking about parity between women and men. So
yeah,
we are equal.
It's interesting also because, you know, we have, people always think that if you're a feminist, you don't want
men around.
Yeah, or that you want people to be the same. But for me, feminism and difference can be celebrated without saying that, oh, we want to be, to have equal spaces in the same way, or similar, you know, we want to be equally respected, we just don't want to be similar. If I want to wear a short skirt, it shouldn't mean that I'm trying to be something, you know. So it's interesting for me to have conversations with men, especially, and how they see that feminist space and how they relate to women wanting to be themselves, and how sometimes it's a very interesting space, and conversation.
Maybe men in general are just worried to lose their rights, their power. They've been powerful during centuries.
Yeah, but I think coming from the African continent, we are a people that are actually ruled by women. Our women have always, our grandmothers were the leaders of our society before colonization. So for me, it's interesting also to talk about feminism in the African space, because I think there's been an erasure of the power of women, and men on the continent were never afraid of women being powerful, because we had powerful women and men also had their space and they were fine until, you know, there was this process of emasculation and humiliation with colonization, and so men took it out on women, like, oh, if we're gonna be dominated, then we also have to find somebody else to dominate. But we existed peacefully before. We didn't even have to be in the same space in order to respect each other. And that's why even when people are talking about the Muslim space, like, it didn't matter if, even during that religious time, if women are in their space and men are in their space, that didn't mean that you were not equal. It's just this whole colonial concept of gender, and like, and that's why gender is an important thing in Django as well,
and
in
racism,
my film.
Racism.
Yeah, absolutely. Because for us, anything that was different and didn't conform did not mean that it was bad. There was room for mediums who, for instance, didn't have a specific gender, you know,
exactly.
And they existed, and they were seen as special. They talked to the gods, they talked to the ancestors.
Like in Polynesia, they've got a gender without any specific things.
Yeah.
Which are very important to the communication, mystical communication.
Absolutely. It was very mystical, and now it's seen as evil. It's seen as barbaric, it's seen as demonic. So I'm very interested in those things and those conversations about how, you know, the introduction of like white patriarchy just changed everything. Mm. Yeah.
Nitu, you were saying about the importance, the thing they did obtain as women in Africa, in Uganda, in the whole continent.
Yeah.
And during the fight for independence,
yeah,
the women were still in the villages while the men were trying to fight against the colonial power.
Mm-hmm.
They did an important play in the history.
Yeah.
And we have a tendency to forget about it.
We do, and I think even now, presently, like, women are still fighting on the continent, but there's less stories. And I have a documentary that actually I just finished about one of those women, and I think for me why it's important to tell women's stories.
What's the title?
The Woman Who Poked the Leopard.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, and I think for me it's important to bring women back into cinema and the role that they're playing constantly in the resistance on the continent, in trying to remind us also of the pre-colonial power that we had and the pre-colonial, I don't want to call it peace, but sort of coexistence that existed, even with, you know, civil wars and whatever. There was sort of this understanding that, you know, and like you said, when men were off at war, the women were always in charge.
Keeping the society.
Yeah, and the society moved on and it, you know, it prospered. So I think we're forgetting a lot of that. And for me, focusing on women's stories, or, you know, is not to say that men's stories are not important. It's just that they've been centered for so long. And I want to bring back just a little bit of more women, more. And I like older women because for us, older women are the symbol of wisdom and leadership in our society. So grandmothers and interesting mothers and unmarried women too, because in our culture, some women went off to marriage and they were, you know, taken up by that space. But we have a big space for unmarried women who have a lot of freedom, who have a lot of leadership that they offer to societies that I think we've sort of forgotten about. Yeah,
they are living in libraries.
Yeah, absolutely. And they have all these stories. And even like in terms of like raising children and whatever, while other people are off like working, there's space for all these unmarried women that just took care of the way society functions. And I think now, because we've put all these binaries and we're making our families smaller.
And labels to people.
Yeah.
We put labels.
Yeah, a lot of labels that didn't exist for us, you know. We actually, in my language, there's no he or she. It's just a person. A person is a person. And
what is your language?
It's called Runyankole. Runyankole. Thank and you. In Runyankole, we have no he, we have no she, we have no this construct of things have to be male and female. It's, you know, in some spaces maybe it exists, but it's not that important. Yeah,
you are very in advance according to our society in Western countries. Talking about the importance of women in Nigeria, there were a very famous queen, Kahina, that fight 400 years ago against the colonization of Spanish soldier. But I guess in all the continent, there were very important queens as
yes,
well.
Yes, there were very important queens and gods. In my culture, our god was called Nyabinji, and she was a female god. So our creation story is a female creation story. And I think it's sad that we've forgotten all those stories and mythologies in favor of the he god and the creation that's violent. And there was no violence in our creation stories. It's just like a birth of things, of different things, and they keep changing and they evolve. But I think we've been limited now by all these new things that are just like seeking to put a lot of order and seeing the old stories as chaotic. So
you're talking Nitu about mythology, the creation. Since you're a novelist, could you tell us whether there are some books about, or there's no books about Ugandan mythology?
Actually, the book that I know now that's available in many international cities is called Chintu. It's not the story of my culture, my tribe. It's the story of the Baganda, who are a kingdom. We have a lot of kingdoms in Uganda. And this, it's a very interesting book. It's written by a woman called Jennifer Makumbi Nansuga. It's a beautiful book called Chintu. Yeah.
And what about the errands you had from your grandmother, mothers? Mm-hmm. Are you not interested to write them? Because now there is still oral tradition communication, but nowadays some oral tradition is losing the weight in the society. Do you think it's important to have books now? Written?
Yeah, there's books, but I think it's also important to have like audio stuff that's available. And I run a podcast called Maganire, which is a folktale, a podcast dedicated to African folktales, because I miss that. I miss the time. It's sort of like a digital fireplace where you tell stories and we preserve them in the mother tongue and also translate them to English where possible. So I'm very, very interested in that, yeah.
Talking again about Locarno, how did you feel to share, well, you still have days left, but how do you feel to share this community with all these filmmakers from your continent?
You know, the sad thing is that on the continent, it's so hard to travel to each other's countries. So we meet Africans more, especially African filmmakers, when we travel to festivals. So it's really cool now to be at Open Doors, where there's actually more African filmmakers that are here. And I think for us as African filmmakers, we're trying to do a lot of that collaboration, you know, between us and breaking all those borders that our colonizers sort of put there in front of us and have been limiting us from working with each other. So it's really been great. I've made friends. I'm excited to work with the filmmakers that I've met during this Open Doors program, because it's been running even before we came to Locarno. We've met online. So it's really great. To meet people from West Africa, from North Africa, from Southern Africa. It's cool.
You told us about your work in dance, theaters, your formation on theater. You work with Klaus Schwer.
Klaus Schrowange. Yes. I was still at university when I worked with Klaus Schrowange.
You went to Berlin?
No, he came to Uganda. Oh. We actually formed a theater troupe together called Rafiki. And we toured. We toured around East Africa. We formed theater troupes. We did a lot of work. We were very inspired by a lot of similar people like Jerzy Grotowski and Gabor Zaneski and Augusto Boal from Brazil. So it was a very interesting time to be young and traveling around East Africa. And,
which countries?
We went to South Sudan. We went to Kenya. We went to Rwanda. And performed and formed some, we actually formed a theater troupe in South Sudan in a beautiful, beautiful village called Kuron, where there's a bishop that had been, that created a peace village. He was a negotiator between the rebels and the government during the different wars that were happening at the time. And so he invited us to this place, this beautiful, beautiful place called Kuron. And we formed a theater troupe there to be able to talk about the project of peace that he was very passionate about.
Yeah. And I think it was a great life experience for the audience.
It was wonderful. It was some of my best performances were in that village, because we had to walk and perform at night, because, you know, it's a community of nomads, so they only are at home at night. So performing under like stars in the middle of, you know, trees and stuff, it was so magical. It was almost like a mythical experience, yeah.
Like in the Piazza Grande, but even better.
Yeah, with no, you know, buildings, no, you know, in the grass. And we sometimes had to, like, take off our shoes, so you just feel like the communion with nature. It was beautiful.
Between earth and sky.
Yes, absolutely.
Between the cosmos and
Yeah.
Like a link between the past and future.
Absolutely. Between all the elements of air and earth and, yeah. It's cool.
I think you work as a novelist or as a filmmaker. Utopism is very important.
Absolutely. I think especially for colonized people, I think we've experienced a lot of pessimism, because colonization has gone on for too long, and people think, oh, you got independence, but we haven't got independence. We have
denying the culture.
Yeah, we still have a lot of people that are pulling the strings of our countries. They have never left. They're still there in the background. So I think for a lot of African people and a lot of other colonized people, it's very important to talk about utopia as a process. Mm. Even though we haven't arrived, we haven't reached there, I think it's important to dream through creation of stories and imagine how we'll get there to our proper and full liberation. Yeah.
Yeah, you're talking about still being colonized.
Yeah.
It's neo-colonialism.
Yeah.
We think about Chinese or Russian, no?
It's different forms of colonization. Of course, there's economic colonization happening with the, you know, what people call the East or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But also there's like a still very heavy hand presence of a lot of countries that still are creating a lot of... profit from making a lot of profit from our people and not, you know,
from
giving
the
right. Yes, they're creating wealth from our countries and taking it back to their countries. The Uganda and Tanzania now are signing a deal to create the world's longest heated crude oil pipeline in East Africa, and all that money is going to those countries, you know, that are investing in that, and our people are being displaced and they're given a little money. But we're people who depend on the land, and the land is being left, you know, to rot, you know, after all the drilling, there's no plan how we're going to restore this land. Our people depend mostly on farming.
To grow plants.
Yeah, so it's, you know, it's like you're taking away people's ways of life and you're not replacing it with anything. And it's still very complicated. It's very, very complicated. Yeah.
And especially people living on the land have to go to the city, to the main city.
Yeah,
there won't be any more work for them.
If, and also, like, you know, there's this thing about us living on our land and eating organic food. We grow everything for ourselves. So now if you're pushing people into the city, that means people have to buy food and they have to buy it, you know, that means they have to eat a lot of unhealthy food. They have to eat... junk and all that stuff, whereas, you know, now, and Uganda is one of the most fertile places in the world, you know, people grow food in their backyard and they don't need anything. So if you're taking that away because you want to make money for, you know,
profit.
A few companies,
profit,
yeah, it's very interesting, you know. Yeah.
Can I ask you about the situation of Uganda after Donald Trump's taxes?
You know, in East Africa, it's very complicated because the stuff that's communicated on the news is not really the truth. Because even when they talk about, like, we're right next to Congo and Rwanda and South Sudan and
Burundi
and Kenya and Tanzania, so we're in the middle of a lot of these wars that people claim it's our wars, but they're not our wars. Our presidents are puppets for all these countries. And they're the ones making the profit. So, you know, we have a lot of displaced people in East Africa. Uganda has one of the highest numbers of refugees. And yes, it's because we're very hospitable people, but it's also because our government is being used to wage war in countries where they shouldn't, you know, wage war. So it's just like all these people that are using our leaders. Our leaders are not our leaders. They're puppets for all these presidents that want to make money, want to steal money, to steal Congo's wealth and to steal, you know, our wealth. So it's very hard to talk about because a lot of people just say, oh, it's very direct. It's this rebel group that attacked this. It's not that simple, you know. There's always somebody pulling strings. Yeah.
Like in North Kivu.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, it's clear now after the deals that have been made and who's going to benefit from that.
It has been lasted for long years and it was just hidden. We didn't understand the situation.
I don't think it's been hidden. It's just that the way it's reported here is different. I think for us, our people have always known. I mean, the Belgian king has stolen from Congo for the longest time possible. And
one
other
century.
Countries, yeah, other countries came in. All these other countries have been there. You know, the UN, you know, like, we like to pretend that the UN has been helping, but no, it's been enabling all this that's
like
happening.
Like during the Rwanda genocide.
Yeah, so it's just like people find that controversial, but it's our truth, it's our reality, you know. Mm-hmm. We have all these people that have no homes because somebody wants to make profit. And they want to pretend that it's not a battle between Rwanda and Congo. No, not at all. It's just all these countries that are using our presidents to steal. Yeah.
It's good to know that. Thank you, Netu. Last question. Yeah. After Locarno, what is coming up to you?
I have a documentary film coming up, so I'm
we'll be
going
out
on to
on the screen.
Yes, soon. It's still secret.
Cross fingers.
Yes, and then I'm also working on my first fiction feature, which is called How to Forget Your Name. And that's an exciting time for me. I'm writing the script and we're going into financing. It's produced by a South African producer called Menzim Tlongo, and we're working together to create an African co-production with, you know, and looking for Latin American co-producers as well. So it's really exciting to put it together. Yeah.
So you will be working in South Africa or Uganda?
Yes.
South Africa.
Yes, we're shooting a little bit in Uganda, but most of it in South Africa. Yeah, it's exciting.
Cross fingers.
Thank you.
Thank you for the very interesting interview.
Thank you too. Thank
and
you so
I
much.
Wish you a great time here in Locarno Open
Thank
Dance.
You. Thank you.
Thank you, Netu.
Thank you.
Keep us informed, please.
Thank you.
Thank you.